Lights, camera, action. Welcome to another episode of the Film and Water Podcast. I am your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me for this episode is Fire and Water Podcast returning guest champ, Mike Gillis, host of the Radio vs. the Martians podcast. Mike, how you doing?
Doing great.
This week we are talking about the 1980 film The Blues Brothers, from directed by John Landis. It's a musical comedy chase film, like I said, directed by John Landis and written by Dan Aykroyd and Landis. Released on June 20th, 1980, it features the story of two ne'er-do-well brothers, Julia Jake and Elwood Blues, played by John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, fresh off their four-year run on Saturday Night Live. After Jake is released from prison, the boys learn the orphanage they grew up in will be closed unless it can raise $5,000. Sent on a mission from God, the Blues Brothers reunite their old band and hit the road to complete their quest. Over the course of the movie, the Blues Brothers run afoul of cowboy crooners, Illinois Nazis — I hate Illinois Nazis — the county, state, and federal police, not to mention an unnamed assassin played by Carrie Fisher, out for revenge on her former fiancé, Jake. It all ends with a massive car chase which spills into the streets of Chicago and into some of its most famous landmarks. The Blues Brothers also features rousing musical performances from a who's who of rhythm and blues legends like Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, John Lee Hooker, Cab Calloway, and James Brown. I really can't possibly be anywhere critical of this movie. I loved it when I was a kid. I don't think I saw it in the theater because I would have been too little. It was rated R, and I don't think my father took me to see an R-rated movie when I was 9. But I saw it pretty soon after that on cable, and I've grown up with it. I've loved it as a teenager in my 20s, and then I just saw it last week on the big screen thanks to the Cinemark Theater's classic series, and I loved it there too. So I'm jealous. Yeah, I can't be anywhere
objective.
That's the word. Thank you. I can't possibly be objective on this film. I just love it. Mike, why do you like this movie so much?
I love this movie for its sheer insanity. What I love about this, I like to think of this movie as essentially Grand Theft Auto the musical, because the casual destruction that they do with just this deadpan attitude in this movie. And it goes from the small where Jake has just been picked up by Elwood coming out of prison. They have this brand new — I'm not even going to say brand, it's new to them — car. It's like this cop car that looks like it has gone through a meat grinder.
Right.
But of course it has, you know, cop brakes, cop engine, cop shocks. And the first thing that he does with it is, of course, the cigarette lighter doesn't work. So Jake just throws it out the window. He's like, throws it out the side of a moving car. And when he starts downing on the car, Elwood's response is to literally jump over a drawbridge in the middle of it lifting up. And they just pull past that. I mean, every time they decide to do something — and this is why I consider this sort of the Grand Theft Auto movie — is, I mean, it doesn't have the gunplay, but it has all the car stuff. It's like they will make, on a split dime moment, this decision to descend the plot into sheer chaos. It's like, yeah, we're going to destroy that. And they commit to it. They destroy so much in the course of this movie. And if that's all the movie was, I think it could be a classic. But you marry it to just this love of the music. And so many movies out there would maybe have a James Brown cameo or a Ray Charles cameo, an Aretha Franklin cameo. They'd appear for one scene and you're like, hey, that's kind of cool. I like how they showed up. Kind of like how Alice Cooper showed up in the Wayne's World movie. Where it's just kind of a neat little appearance. But they do full on performances.
Yeah.
The entire song in this movie, it becomes a musical. And these two things married together just make this an amazing movie.
Yeah, it really does do full service to all of the genres that it's, you know, using. I mean, like you said, it's got these car chases, which are just unbelievable. I mean, and I have to wonder, you know, like that scene you mentioned where they jump over the drawbridge. I mean, it tells you right then and there how cartoony this movie is going to be, despite the fact that it looks very gritty. I mean, the opening scene, the opening scene, which is set above the sort of wastelands of inner city Chicago with these smokestacks, and it's really kind of grim, is very gritty and real. And then, of course, we cut to this thing of the car magically doing things that it can't do. And it's just this weird marriage of grit and complete cartooniness. I mean, the Jake and Elwood get attacked by this mysterious woman who uses a rocket launcher to try and kill them. She blows up the entire front part of the hotel they're going to stay in. And they pick themselves up out of the rubble, dust themselves off, and just walk back upstairs. I mean, they don't even question anything.
Yeah,
they're just like, oh, that was an odd thing. Oh, well.
I love it because you can actually hear bricks falling off of them as they're going up the stairs. Yeah. And the guy sleeping on the stairwell didn't even get up. Yeah. I love it. And it gets even bigger and bigger to the point Carrie Fisher comes back and actually bombs the hotel they live in. It literally is destroyed around them as the cops are about to get them. And they actually pull themselves out of the rubble, dust themselves off, and go to work. I love it. And even the cops are like, oh, they are so nonplussed about everything that happens. I think you see John Belushi's Jake get annoyed a couple times at them. It's just, he's like, oh, come on. But for the most part, they're pretty cool about everything. They're like, oh, man, now I'm going to be chased by a car, you know, cops, and I'm going to go back to jail and blah, blah, blah. Why are you just going to get out of this parking lot? And Jake's like, or Elwood's like, you went out of this parking lot? And he drives into the mall.
Right.
Into one of my favorite sequences in this entire movie. And a friend of mine, Sam Mulvey, who's been on Radio Versus the Martians a couple of times, has said that that mall that the car chase took place in never recovered. That it had been a little bit abandoned and a little bit run down, and it was in this real central area of Chicago. It never recovered. It is a blight on the city now. It never recovered from the Blues Brothers car chase in it. They destroy everything in this mall, and it's one of my favorite examples of product placement, where they say the name of a store, like, oh, the new Oldsmobiles are out.
Yep.
And they just fishtail the back of it and destroy the front of this dealership.
Pier 1 Imports.
Hey, Pier 1 Imports. They destroy everything, and you get the impression, by the way they're doing it, that they're doing it not only just in a nonchalant way, but on purpose. It's just like, well, in for a penny, in for a pound, we might as well destroy this too. Oh, man. It is glorious. The same thing when they actually make an enemy of the Nazis. Is the Nazis are having a rally, and they're just like, I hate Illinois Nazis.
Hate Illinois
and then they
Nazis.
Just make a decision in that moment, and they're like, yeah, let's just drive right at them and drive them into the lake.
Yeah.
And I just love it. I love how they accrue this rogues gallery throughout this movie that I honestly think probably even rivals Batman. They've got the good old boys and the management of Bob's Country Bunker.
Bob's Country Bunker, right?
They all pile into that RV to go out to kill them, and they've got a shotgun in the car, and they destroy these guys like three times throughout the movie. And I actually looked this up because they said that they were going to get paid $200 for stealing another band's gig, the Country Band, the good old boys at this bar. And they said, oh, well, you know, we were going to pay you $200, but you drank $300 worth of beer. And I was like, wait, what? How much is $300 worth of beer? So I actually tracked down a government inflation calculator website. And in 1980 dollars to today, $300 of beer in 1980 equals $861.40 in beer today. That is an insane amount of beer.
Split among eight guys, I think? Is it eight guys?
Eight guys. That's so much beer.
That's a lot of beer.
Just the chaos and the destruction of this movie, I absolutely love it. I love this movie so much. And like you, I can't be critical of it.
Yeah.
Because actually, maybe I can be critical of it because I've revisited so many movies that I loved as a kid and loved growing up, and you just kind of revisit periodically through your life. And a lot of times you just kind of get burned. Your nostalgia goggles just get shattered. And you're like, oh, wow, Thundercats is really bad. And revisiting this movie, I love it more now than I loved it as a kid. I think I appreciate little things that went over my head when I was small. And oh, man, it seems way more bonkers insane as a grown-up than it ever did as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, on paper, it shouldn't work because it's over 2 hours long. It's the official runtime is 133 minutes, and then there's even a director's cut, which is a good 20 minutes longer than that. Comedies generally don't work at that length. Trying to mix in, you know, general mayhem action tends to not work. And I can think of an example of all these elements not working – also featuring the same actors, which is, of course, 1941, made just a year before this.
Oh, God.
Which to me is just painfully unfunny. I keep going back to it every couple of years thinking maybe this is like a lost classic. You know, it's one of those movies that's just easy to dump on. So I go back and I watch again, and I'm like, it's still not funny. It's just not funny. And
it's not.
It's literally the same, almost the same idea. Aykroyd Belushi in a giant action comedy. and it just falls flat on its face. And here's the Blues Brothers with all the same basic ideas, but it works perfectly. You know, I mean, it, I mean, 1941 doesn't have the music, of course. But, I mean, these are two films very similar to one another, and one completely works and the other one does not. And the one that doesn't is by Spielberg, you know, the kind of more renowned director than John Landis.
Yeah, and I'm looking at this, and it felt like to me when I – and we actually had a discussion about Steven Spielberg on Radio Versus the Martians a while ago when we were talking about 1941. And I think 1941 was Spielberg's attempt to do something more like John Landis, more like movies like Porky's, you know, sort of college sex comedy sort of stuff. But – restraining himself because he never allows himself to go quite as bonkers as these guys do. Like, there's a part of him that doesn't want to go rated R. There's a part of him that doesn't want to. And I think maybe the sense that with the Blues Brothers, they're all in.
Oh, yeah.
There's never a point where they're trying to mix. Like, I think 1941 fails because it tries to mix too many things that tonally don't work. Like the high school sex comedy with the, you know, the sort of satirical films like, Dr. Strangelove. Mm-hmm. And on paper, a lot of these ideas would work really well together, but maybe Spielberg wasn't the guy to do it. And it also has this sort of loving recreation of this bygone age where it feels like a Norman Rockwell painting.
Yes.
And all these things are colliding. But I think the difference between that and Blues Brothers is that all of the parts that are used by John Landis and through the writing and the performances of people like, you know, Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi, all fall into sync because this is all stuff they all love and are all good at. They manage to nail it because these pieces match really oddly well together, things that should not work, like the cartoonish reality to the point that I think the thing where they finally defeat the Nazis, they manage to trick them into driving off the edge of this off-ramp. And when you actually see the height from which they fall, it should be like 30 feet. But it looks like they dropped the car out of a plane.
Which they did.
And they drop the car out of a plane, and it makes a literal hole in the asphalt on the street.
Which the Blues Brothers jump over.
And the other Nazi car falls in.
Right.
Yeah, there's so many jumps without ramps in this movie. I love it. I love it so much. They also have a couple instances of what I call the A-Team stunt, which is the single automotive stunt they always did on the A-Team back in the day, which is you drive at something, and you go up a half ramp, and you flip onto the top of your car. Oh, my God, the level of just destruction and practical car effects. I mean, it's really up there with the original Mad Max as far as, you know, I think we've all become so desensitized with CGI crashes nowadays that when suddenly a real crash is happening in front of you, there's like a moment of genuine danger like you're in a real car. And mixing that with absurdist comedy, it's really a chocolate peanut butter thing with me.
Yeah, there's near the end, and when they're being chased around in Chicago, there's a I think like a 20 car pileup, and it's real cars.
Yeah,
it's John Landis literally piling up 20 automobiles, and you're like, I can't believe they did that on the streets of Chicago. I mean, you just can't, you know, you're just sort of amazed by it.
And they're not crashing into the side; they're like jumping up onto the top of this ever growing pile.
It's quite literally a pile
after car, and there's some of them are upside down, and I love it. I love the sheer chaos of this because it's like a giant cartoon. It's a giant rated R cartoon musical. I love the commitment they have to not explaining why Carrie Fisher is trying to kill them until the very end. That it's first the rocket launcher and then a bomb, and then she's got a flamethrower that actually explodes this like kerosene tank next to a payphone that fires it. It looks like 100 feet up into the air. And of course it crashes down and explodes. They're like, oh, hey, there must be $7 in change here. I love how somebody is trying to murder them and it's just like Tuesday to them. Because you just get the impression these guys are regularly like, it's like playing a Grand Theft Auto game where you make a casual decision to sort of break the law. And then things just cascade out of control, and pretty soon you have the army after you, just like they are at the end of this movie, where we see, like, literally hundreds of people playing police officers, National Guardsmen, snipers, SWAT team guys, not even mentioning the Nazis and the country western band, all coming after these two guys who have just a snowball of chaos that just follows in their wake. It's like, I just think from the Grand Theft Auto thing again, what is their criminal star rating at the end of that movie? It's got to be like a 5-star thing where it's just, okay, the army showed up. I think that's 6 stars. I think we fully accomplished it now. I love its commitment to go as far with this premise as they possibly can.
That final scene reminds me of something that you mentioned on the last time you were on Fire and Water. One of the things you love, you said that you were a total sucker for, is the guards seize them. scene, like of somebody yelling. And this almost has that. Because it's got, you know, the Blues Brothers stop at that little guy's booth and they're like, where's the Cook County Assessor's Office? And he's like, down the hall, make a right, 11th floor. Thank you. And then they run off. And then you've got all those guys saying, did you just send two guys in a black suit, black hat down there? Yeah, I just sent it down that way. Okay, thank you. And then, and there's this wave of people. And it's like, that is as close as we could get to them being the seize them routine. Because it's all these guys just trying to apprehend the Blues Brothers.
I love how the safety is off on all of the cops, too. There's a moment where they've just decided that whatever restraint they normally have as police officers is just gone. Like, after they get out of that massive, like, 20-car crash, and they see the Blues Brothers driving off away from them, they all start pulling out their guns and firing in the direction of the fleeing car. And the same thing, when the Blues Brothers get into that building, what I love is it's, like, this massive, insane car chase, and as soon as they get into the building, and they just start blocking meticulously each door, like, they pick up the bench, they knock over the two vending machines, they push those towards it, it's like this huge stack, as each the cops get to each barrier, they don't even dismantle it. They just start firing machine guns at the door to dismantle them through the door. And I just love how quiet the scenes with them are as they're going up the elevator, quietly filling out the paperwork. And then they look up and there's like 500 guns pointed right at them.
Right. And of course, the guy that they give the money to, the Cook County assessor, is in fact Steven Spielberg.
I love that.
One of the other things that I do love about this movie is that amid all this chaos and this bigness, I mean, the movie celebrates, you mentioned, sort of celebrates bigness, is all these little details. I mean, like when they go to the country western bar and he asks them, what kind of music do you usually play here? And she goes, oh, we have both kinds, country and western.
And
then they end up playing they first play Rawhide because their old set doesn't work well with these, you know, cowboy guys. And then they play
Just throwing beer bottles at them.
And then they play Stand By Your Man, and there's all these shots of these lovey-dovey trucker couples, and then there's just a single of one guy crying in his beer because he's all by himself. And it's just the fact that a movie this big takes the time for that little gag, you know, is such a wonderful little detail.
I think that's the thing that really makes this movie work, is that these huge things happen and they have these quiet reaction in moments. Not only them, like, watching their car fall apart at the end of this movie. They get out of the car, and we've seen this car do these insane things, and it just falls apart into literal pieces. It just collapses, and the wheels fall off, and it's like everything's just gone, and they just stare at it for a couple seconds. And then they turn around and leave.
Yeah.
And they always have that quiet reaction shot. They let it slowly happen. Like, when they go into the penguin, the nun's office, and
Kathleen Freeman, playing the nun.
Oh, she's born to play roles like that. She's got a great voice for that. She tells them to have a seat, and they sit in these old, like, 1950s, like, classroom desks, you know, with the wraparound.
Yeah, like the one-piece desks, yeah.
Oh, I love it. And she asks them, it's like, oh, come closer, boys, so I can see your faces. And it's them slowly scooting forward. And they just drag that shot out to really just make it kind of awkward and weird. And when she finally drives them out of it, I love how Jake never fully gets out of the desk and he falls down the staircase.
It's an amazing stunt.
With this desk still oh my God, it looks so dangerous. And the desk just breaks off of him at the bottom of the stairs. It's just, oh man. Oh, it's just the little things, like when the nun is hitting them for blaspheming and swearing and she just starts hitting them back and forth. It's like, ah, Jesus, ah, shit, oh, God damn. And then she just breaks the end of the ruler off on Dan Aykroyd's head.
Hello, boys. Nice to see you. Please, have a seat. No, no, boys. Come over here in front of me. I want to see your faces. The county took a tax assessment of this property last month. They want $5,000.
Doesn't the church have to pay that?
They would if they were interested in keeping the place. But they aren't. The Archbishop wants to sell this building outright to the Board of Education.
What's going to happen to you?
I'll be sent to the missions. Africa. Latin America. Korea.
Forget it. $5,000, no problem. We'll have it for you in the morning. Let's go, Elwood.
No, no! I will not take your filthy, stolen money.
Well, then. I guess you're really up shit creek.
Oh! I beg your pardon. What did you say?
I offered to help you.
Mm-hmm.
You refused to take our money.
Mm-hmm.
Then I said, I guess you're really up shit creek.
Ow!
Christ, Jake, take it easy, man.
Elwood.
Ow! Jesus Christ.
Ow!
Jesus Christ!
Ow! Oh,
shit! Ow!
Fuck you, man!
Bitch! Hey! Jesus Christ!
Son of a bitch! Ow, you fat penguin!
Ah!
Ah!
Oh. Fuck this noise, man!
Just it always takes it that step further, but it always plays the moment straight. I think that's what makes it work. I think that's what it is, and that's the difference between it and 1941. 1941 is going it's a joke. You get it. Where this one plays it like it's drama, but it's doing something so cartoonishly absurd with utter sincerity.
Yes. Yeah.
That it becomes funny because to them this is their life. This is their world that they're in. And the things they're doing make absolute sense in a cartoon world. And it's so absurd, played with such a straight voice to it, that I think it just can't help but be hilarious. Because it's not trying too hard.
Yeah. And another thing I like is there is an inherent sweetness between the two brothers. I mean, there's a loyalty there. I mean, when they go back to Elwood's apartment, which, of course, is right by the L trains, and Jolie Jake says, how often does the train go by? So often you won't even notice it. Belushi, Jolie Jake lays down on Elwood's bed, and you hear Elwood say, I got to get some sleep. And he realizes that Jake has stolen his bed from him. And he says, you know, hey, you sleaze my bed. And then he pauses and he pulls a blanket up over Jake's sleeping body and sits down in a chair. And it's like just that little moment. It's such a nice thing of like, you know, these two are complete and utter criminals. They cannot be trusted. They steal things throughout the movie, whether it be food, windshield wiper blades. I mean, they are totally criminals. But yet they have a loyalty to one another that I think anybody can relate to, whether it's your friend or your relative or whatever. But it's the fact that Elwood will not let anything bad happen to his brother. There's something just so wonderful about that. And you can't help but feel that that is a reflection of the real relationship between Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi. You know, you just feel like that's them on the screen, despite the fact that they're playing these absurd characters.
And I think my favorite one of those little moments is that when Jake was in prison, Elwood continues to write him letters, but has been lying to him about the band staying together.
Yeah.
To him, he's like, oh, no, as soon as we get out of jail, it'll be great. We can start up. We can keep playing. But the band has all kind of gone their separate ways without these two guys, these two powerful personalities keeping them together. And they've gone about and gotten real jobs, like grown-up jobs. And when Jake is like, why did you lie to me? It's like, and he goes, oh, I just didn't know. And he's like, he goes, you lied to me. And he goes, it wasn't a lie. It was just, you know, bullshit. And I love that little moment where he's just like, he doesn't want his brother to hurt. He doesn't want to take the one thing away from him that gives him some hope in there. And I just love the differentiation between the idea of straight out lying to someone, which would be hurtful, and bullshit, which isn't.
There's something to this. There's something about this film's sort of view of economics, too, that it makes me laugh every time. There's the scene where they go and they visit the big chunk of their band, which is now recast as Murph and the Magic Tones, which is this sort of horrible Holiday Inn band. And he's talking to they're talking to the five of them, telling, you know, Bones Malone and Donald Duck Dunn and Steve Cropper and Murph himself and Willie Hall. And they're talking to the guys and they're like, where are the other guys? And he says, oh, well, this guy is a maitre d' at a fancy restaurant. He's pulling down six bills a week. And then they say McIntyre Murphy got himself married and is a fry cook at a soul food restaurant. And then the drummer says, you'll never get those guys out of those high paying gigs. And I thought, a fry cook at a diner is somehow a high-paying gig. Yeah, you know, don't want to pull it down from that magical job. Like, what are you talking about? But, like, that's how sort of close to the bone all these guys are operating in terms of their finances. Like, this is, you know, I mean, as you mentioned about the thing with the phone booth, they're scraping coins off the ground. You know, that's how broke the Blues Brothers are.
I love that. But there's a sort of that view of the world that we get so many of these movies that take place in Chicago or filmed in Chicago. You look at The Dark Knight, which is a Chicago movie, even though it's not called Chicago. But it's all the pretty parts of Chicago. There are no Bruce Wayne charity galas in this movie.
Yeah, no.
This is a really gritty kind of – it has so much personality and a sense of place. And I know that a lot of people I know who've lived in Chicago say this is their movie, that it is to Chicago what the Ghostbusters movie is to New York, where it really just embraces this city and its culture and its landmarks. And I don't have that kind of personal attachment. I think I was in the Chicago airport once, which I don't know if that really counts. I think you have to take a step outside the airport to really count like you've been in Illinois. But it does have this distinctive sense of place that this movie, I think, could have only taken place in Chicago.
Yeah.
And it feels so much like Chicago. And I love that sense of place that a lot of movies really don't have. It's just like we film in Vancouver and we call it whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it does not feel like that at all. I love it to death.
It's funny that you mentioned Ghostbusters because, of course, that was also written by Aykroyd. And as far as I understand about how the Blues Brothers script came about, I mean, it was being written by Aykroyd while he was still on Saturday Night Live and they were producing a deal. And that caused not a bit of friction among the rest of the cast because it seemed like that Belushi and Aykroyd were sort of getting lifted out of the show and were sort of heading for a new level of stardom that the rest of the cast did not. And there was some jealousy there of kind of like, geez, guys, you're going to do a, you know, like this thing is just a gag, this Blues Brothers thing. You're taking it really seriously. And apparently Aykroyd's original script was unshootable. You know, it was like 500 pages, and it was just – and it was Landis, John Landis, that got a hold of it. And Aykroyd handed it off to Landis and just said, you fix it. And Landis was the one that stripped it down, and got it to where it was shootable, which is the same exact thing that happened on Ghostbusters. And that's what they did with Harold Ramis. I mean, the original Ghostbusters script that Aykroyd wrote had them, like, going to outer space, and there was, like, dozens of Ghostbusters, and there were flashbacks.
And time travel.
Time travel, and Ivan Reitman got it and just said, we can't make this movie.
Yeah, the beginning of the original Ghostbusters script had Stay Puft Marshmallow Man as an afterthought at the beginning.
Yeah.
So I think that's really what Dan Aykroyd needs. I think he's really an idea man, in the sort of way that George Lucas is an idea man.
Yes.
And you need a second writer to ground it. And I think that he had that with Harold Ramis on Ghostbusters, and he really had that with John Landis on Blues Brothers, is that you need that other person that knows how to actually translate this into the language of movie. And they just nail it. I think he has such a great sense of imagination and humor that you just have to know how to focus that through something.
Yeah,
and I think that he's just somebody who's born to co-write brilliant things with other really talented guys.
Yeah, something I wanted to ask you, just because I've never really considered it before now or sort of until I was an adult, but like, is the Blues Brothers, in your opinion, good music, or is it a gag?
When I
was growing up, when I was growing up, I watched Saturday Night Live. My parents let me watch Saturday Night Live, even though I was much too young to understand it, and I just accepted it all. You know, I mean, I didn't think about it. I'm like, well, the Blues Brothers really, there's no humor here. It's just music. You know, like, and if you go back and watch the Carrie Fisher hosted episode, which was in the fourth season, ironically enough, Carrie Fisher plays Jake's ex-girlfriend. Well, she actually dated Dan Aykroyd in real life. The episode that Carrie Fisher hosted in the fourth season opens with a Blues Brothers number. And there's no jokes. It's just the Blues Brothers doing Soul Man. And it is probably my single favorite cold open Saturday Night Live ever did, because the energy level is so high that it's the perfect thing for a live show. And in that moment, I'm like, no, this is genuinely good music. This is not a gag or a fake, like a parody of soul music. This is genuinely good music. But it's there are other people who don't consider it such because they feel like, oh, it's sort of, you know, famous white guys sort of stealing black music. But I don't know, I've come to sort of come around to think, no, this is actually pretty good.
Yeah, I'm on the same camp as you are. I look at it and there's an enthusiasm and a love for the music that, I mean, you think about anyone else doing this movie and they wouldn't think to get cameos, if not outright musical performances through people like James Brown and Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles and stuff like that. They wouldn't think of that. And yeah, those guys are all superior musicians to Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi. But John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd have this enthusiasm, which is infectious, that they love this music. They may not be the best musicians in the world, but they love it so much and they're competent. And I enjoy watching them perform. I mean, I'm not a music guy that can really lay out all of the specific technical blah 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 whatever what have you, but it's fun to watch, and there's a clear joy in that. The musical sequences are just as important and just as big as any of the car chases throughout this movie. There's a love there that normally you just have a bit and a piece of a song, but they do the whole thing.
Yep.
And they just infect so much life into it. And from what I've heard, it's not just a couple of white guys stealing music. The careers of a lot of the people who were in it, like Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles, had this huge resurgence after they appeared in this movie. They started selling a lot more records. So a lot of people who wouldn't have otherwise been introduced to these great musicians were introduced to them and became new fans. So to me, that's always a win. Even if you don't like their particular performance style, then you have to give it to them that they opened up a lot of really great musicians to whole new audience.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I was one of those. At 9 or 10, I had no interest or even knowledge of James Brown, but I was like, that's a good song. That's, you know, like when he breaks into that song and that's the thing that inspires Jake to go on the mission from God. It's like, this is good. I like this. This is good. You know, so it probably did that number on me. And it is amazing to me. Like, as you mentioned about, there are some films that don't age well as you grow up. But this thing has stayed the same to me for no matter what age I'm at. I laugh at it every single time. And when we saw it on the big screen, it was filled with laughter. The theater was just filled with laughter. People were just you know, laughing at it from beginning to end. And I was like, that's such a great thing to hear, that this movie is, you know, 35 years old at this point. And yeah, exactly, actually 35 years old. And it holds up, you know. I mean, it's considered a classic, and it's people still remember it and love it. And so it really is every bit as fun as it was when it came out.
Absolutely. It's a movie that holds up. It's a timeless movie. And I think that's the best thing you can have, is you can show an audience in 2015 a movie from 1980, and it's just as good as anything there. There isn't this like disconnect culturally or generationally, that it's still just as good. And how many movies can you say that about? I can think about how many movies come out every single year that I forget about the minute I stop watching.
Yeah.
That they're just so utterly forgettable. And this is just a classic that I still casually make references to this movie in conversation. Every time I drive past Pier 1 Imports, I say, Pier 1 Imports. I can't not do that. I mean, every time I hear any reference to Nazis, neo-Nazis, I hate Illinois Nazis. I can't not. I mean, I love it. There's been several times I've been playing games like Grand Theft Auto, and I've tried to recreate Blues Brothers moves. Like, I think I can jump that. I love it. It's just such a bonkers movie, and I think it's the sort of movie you couldn't do today. You couldn't get any studio to sign on to do a musical that's a rated R that has car chases, and to get all these great musicians, many of which sadly aren't with us anymore, to do full-on performances like Cab Calloway, James Brown, Aretha Franklin. I know we just list off these names a bunch of times, but this really happened. They were all in a movie together. And it's also a movie where a bunch of Nazis go off a cliff in a car. And it's just great. I love it so much. This movie is absolute bonker.
Well, I said, we're going to end it there, because I said, for any of you who've been listening to this, I think you can tell Mike and I love this movie. And if you haven't seen it, go see it. It's available on Netflix. If you have ever a chance to see it on a big screen, go see it on a big screen, because it really does. It's a rare comedy that works really well on a big screen. I mean, John Landis really gives you a lot, more bang for your buck than you could possibly imagine for a comedy, a musical comedy. So that is The Blues Brothers. We love it. And I guess before we wrap up this episode, Mike, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Well, I primarily host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. We like to call it the McLaughlin Group for Nerds, sort of a panel discussion show. We just did an episode on Quentin Tarantino. You can find us online on radioversusthemartians.com. We're also available on Stitcher, Twitter, Facebook, and iTunes.
Awesome. And if you want to send feedback about Film and Water, shoot an email to the main Fire and Water podcast feed, which is firewaterpodcast@comcast.net.
So until next time, we'll see you at the movies.
Who wants an orange whip? Orange whip? Orange whip? Three orange whips.